Someone told you knee pain is just getting older? They were wrong. The Joint Relief Institute offers fast joint pain relief covered by Medicare. Call 708-888-0000, as in zero pain.
This is a story we've all been following with great fascination and horror. The 84-year-old Nancy Guthrie was abducted from her Tucson home. She is the mother of the Today host, Savannah Guthrie. There was a ransom note that was sent to a station. We don't know if it was from the actual kidnappers or abductors. But what I thought we'd do today is really talk about the issue of hostage negotiation. And with us is one of the foremost experts in the world, Calvin Krusty. He is a senior partner and critical risk consultant at Critical Risk Team. He's been in the business for three decades, working at the very most serious problems in high-risk environments. He started out as a Royal Canadian Mounted Police senior operations officer, and he became involved with the International Negotiators Team. He holds an honors in law, master's in law, and dispute resolution negotiations, and he is an expert in this area. Thank you so much for joining us and lending some expertise to this issue. Thank you, Calvin.
Thanks, Karen, for the very gracious introduction.
I'm just curious, before we get into this, how did you actually get into the area of hostage negotiations from your law enforcement background?
Well, I actually, it's an interesting question. I actually just fell in it by chance. And back in 1993, I was a young policeman who applied for the UN to deploy to the former Yugoslavia for a peace-making operation with the UN at the height of the war in 1993. And I was, because of my investigative background, I was assigned to a special investigative team. And my first case was a very grave, ugly human rights case. But the second case that I had later that week was a hostage-taking slash kidnapping in the war. And I just fell into it, and I quickly realized in wars, kidnapping and hostage-taking was a very common activity. And I realized that investigating isn't going to solve the problem, but negotiating is going to probably be more useful, and mediation in this particular case. So that's how I got involved in it, and I spent the first tour of duty there for 6 months doing nothing but, and then I went back again 6 months later, and it just became part of my life.
Very, very interesting, and I'm going to circle back with some of the things you said here. How common is kidnapping outside of the area of war?
Well, I think it's very common, probably not. I mean, the kidnap for ransom, you know, that's hitting the headlines with the Guthrie case, in terms of the concerns of it, is not that common. But I think it's fairly common, particularly like within certain segments of society, i.e. within organized crime elements, within the various diaspora communities, within, say, North American communities. In some countries like Mexico, Brazil, Colombia, more common as a means of business and dispute resolution. So depending where. But a lot of it's not reported, particularly the activity in organized crime.
Yes, let's just, are we conceding that this is a kidnapping, or could this just be an abduction or something else altogether? We don't know that yet. Is that fair to say?
I think that's very fair to say, and I think probably most appropriate to say. I think, you know, not being at the table in the investigative rooms, you know, don't have all the insights. But there's no indication at this point that there's ongoing communication from the suspects, you know, looking for a ransom to, you know, make it a kidnapping. So I would say that it's probably something from the outset of the case was a consideration. But as time goes on, if there isn't some type of reach out in terms of communication with the demands, which defines the kidnapping in terms of a ransom versus a simple abduction where the person just goes missing or taken against their will for other reasons or purposes, I don't know if at this time we can say it's a kidnapping, but I'm guessing that it's possibly still on the table as a possibility. But again, with the time that's gone on, probably less and less likely.
We are talking to Calvin Krusty. He is an expert in international negotiation, hostages. Thank you so much for hanging with us. Calvin, what do you have to know to be a hostage negotiator? What kind of training do you get, and in what kinds of areas?
Well, that's another great question. I think it's, you know, it's a team sport, you know, for lack of a better term. And there's different roles and responsibilities. You know, I've once heard the categorization of hostage negotiators, and particularly in the context of kidnap negotiations, that there's three general types. And I wish I could remember the name of the fellow to give him credit for his classification. But in short, there's those that are empathetic negotiators, those that are pragmatic negotiators, and those that are strategic negotiators. And I've rarely found, you know, that's kind of the types of attributes looking at in terms of participating and engaging in these forms of negotiations. And to be quite frank, I've rarely seen a person have all three attributes, although I do find some people like to advance that they do, but I haven't actually seen it. I've seen people that are really strong with empathetic listening skills in terms of, you know, the communication with the hostage takers, and in terms of dealing with the family, in terms of family management, and these having those particular skills, because quite often they're engaged and you're working with them. The pragmatic person is just, you know, getting down to business and, you know, looking at the pragmatic and practical aspects of the operation in terms of, you know, organizational skills, having familiarity with the investigative issues. And then there's the strategic ones that are looking at planning and trying to be a step ahead or two or three steps ahead of the kidnappers in terms of planning, strategizing, and outmaneuvering them, managing the risk, etc. So those are the three types of attributes, you know, looking at. But in terms of, you know, the type of training that one gets, like in the U.S., the primary area is the FBI course. In the U.K. is the British U.K. Course. I'm at Hendon College, Canada. We have a course here as well. I've been trained in all three places, the FBI, Scotland Yard, and here locally. And then I think it's just a lot of experience. You know, in terms of, it's more than just, say, for example, like a lot of those that are in the crisis negotiation / hostage negotiation world, a lot of their cases are particularly to de-escalate people that are on a bridge, say, or suicidal, et cetera, et cetera. But those skills, you know, and there's a little bit of an argument or disagreement there. Do those skills always transfer over to be in terms of kidnapping negotiations? I don't think so. I think you need a slight different skill set. You need those plus some others, and the others are extreme awareness in terms of criminal investigations and having, you know, strong interactions historically with the criminal element to be able to know how to talk to them, to understand their way of thinking, et cetera, and to be able to work within that team environment, i.e. the larger criminal investigative team.
So, and this is just in general, this is not having to do with the case of the Guthrie family, but is that ever the case where there is a feeling that law enforcement is interested? Of course they're interested in getting the loved one back. Of course they are. There's no question. But that they will put as a priority maybe catching the wrongdoer over getting the loved ones back. And the family might opt not to follow what the law enforcement is telling them to do. Does that happen on a frequent basis, or are most of the time the interests of law enforcement and the families aligned?
I find it's not so much the interests don't align. I find in most cases the interests do align. I think what happens sometimes just because it's a unique type of crime, and the crime in law enforcement, you know, one of the terminologies are crimes in action. So they're actually taking place live time as you're engaged in it, versus a crime that happened and then you're investigating, you know, a break-in happened last week, or a robbery happened today, or a murder happened a month ago, and it's kind of like a reactive response, where this is like you're participating and you're engaged in it. And in this particular one, I think it's a shift in the mindset that I think once you're in that crisis and once you're in the moment, it's easy to forget, I think, for many that participate. And it's not done with ill intent or insensitivities, but just because part of the police investigative culture is always to pursue catching the bad guy. And sometimes you just need to be reminded. But, you know, great leaders in those type of circumstances and those with the experiences make sure that everybody's in the team is briefed, reminded, and the whole strategic approach is to, you know, the safe recovery of the person that was taken, i.e. the hostage. And second is, you know, gathering the evidence of the pursuit of the bad guys. But it does take a lot of effort just to keep everybody on the same page, particularly when the emotions are high.
Oh, yes.
And you fall back to the old ways of doing things.
Yeah, I can imagine that people are not making family members are maybe not making the wisest decisions, or they wouldn't make the most the smartest decisions had they not had strong law enforcement telling them that they're the experts in how these things work. Analyzing ransom notes, and again, we don't know what the contents of any of the ransom notes were, or if in fact they were related to a person who perhaps has Ms. Guthrie. But how do you analyze a ransom note, and how do you assess whether this is just an opportunist who wants to cash in on a missing person versus a person who really is motivated by getting money in exchange for a human life?
Well, whether it's a note or whether it's a voice recording, just for verification, and often, you know, particularly the higher profile it is, the more likely you're going to get either hoaxes or fraudulent claims that, you know, a person or persons are affiliated to the actual kidnapping and have access to the hostage in those particular cases. So the verification process is called proof of life, and the proof of life is the process where investigators verify through various techniques, some of them sensitive techniques, but done through communication with the kidnappers to verify that they do in fact have access to the hostage and they are the ones that have some type of control influence in the particular situation.
And what do you make, if anything, of the fact that the hostage, the ransom note came a little bit later after Nancy Guthrie was missing? Would that be a red flag for you that this was an opportunist rather than the person who may have abducted her?
Well, it's hard to say. You know, I've been in every kidnapping that I've been into has had a unique set of circumstances. So, you know, I've worked all around the world, you know, on all the different continents, you know, in terms of terrorist kidnappings, criminal kidnappings, and domestic ones, i.e. my own country. And each and every one's different. So I know there's always a tendency to people, particularly even within the police community, to go to, you know, the fallback analysis is what happened in the last one, and this is different. So is this... But I don't know if one can really do that. Each one's different. I've been involved in, you know, terrorist kidnappings or others where they're taking the time and they don't ask for the ransom right away because they're either traveling or trying to set up what I would refer to as their own operational security. So they're safe and secure with the hostage. So they're taking time to make sure, you know, they've are secure themselves before engaging. So it's, you know, particularly those where it was an opportunist type of kidnapping. So I wouldn't put too much weight in terms of the time delay. I think, you know, at this time delay in terms of several weeks, I think we can put some weight into that when there's that much delay and it's a domestic case, i.e. within one's own nation, like within the U.S., that type of delay, you know, if somebody came forward, I'd definitely be looking at more random hoax situations.
We have just a couple minutes before we have to take a break. This is really fascinating. Do you see when the family left some messages, there were some strange words, at least I thought they were strange, but what do I know, about we want our mother back so we can celebrate with her, words to that effect. Is it possible that the words that the family is using in these messages are somehow messaging the abductor or the hostage taker to be more sympathetic or empathetic to their mother, or some other message that they're sending?
I would suggest, you know, they're trying to keep the door open for communication and also to personalize the victims in this case, i.e. the family members, for some type of consideration, you know, whether it be a kidnap situation, whether it be an abduction, or whether it be something more nefarious, you know, in terms of perhaps the location of the person, of the victim in this particular case. So, yes, I would say there were probably well thought out communication to be respectful and to open up any type of communication means for whatever, you know, and they want in terms of communication with the suspects.
I've got a lot of questions here. I had a texter who said, do you ever see when people win the lottery that they get kidnapped? Is that something that you see or you've ever seen?
Well, it's a good question. I've actually had to, in our private business, have been called as an expert witness for a public court case by lottery commissions about the risk to people in lottery cases once they're named as huge winners regarding kidnapping. But it's something that I haven't, you haven't asked, but I'm just going to inject something here, is what's happening, I think, with the kidnapping world, and I think this is really worth sharing with listeners, including the person that raised this question, is with the information and social media and digital world that we live in, kidnappings, I think, are going down probably a little bit. And the ones that are becoming higher but similar are the extortions, where you don't have to take the body, but they have the psychological control over you.
Okay.
And I think that's what we're seeing in terms of a rise in terms of all types of activities, you know, whether it be the lottery or whether it be in other forms. And it's obviously much lower risk. And so instead of using a person, the capturing of a person as their leverage for the coercion, they just do it psychologically through digital means and communications and technology. And that's what we're seeing. And we're seeing it a lot. I mean, we have a crisis up here in Canada in Surrey, British Columbia, in the greater Vancouver area, where like hundreds of extortions are happening through digital means. And it's becoming a bigger and bigger issue. And we're even dealing with clients, you know, in terms of the blackmail, the cryptocurrency extortions. Like it's changing and it's evolving, you know, in a number of different areas.
So if you're what you're talking about, what would be a typical extortion issue? You know, is this like pictures, incriminating pictures, information? What are you seeing when it comes to extortion?
Well, we're seeing a lot of different forms, but yes. So obviously online exposure to something inappropriate, you know, in terms of pornography, et cetera, to lifestyle in terms of doing something inappropriate in your lifestyle, where people brush up against criminal organizations and maybe have inappropriate sexual relationships with somebody and then get blackmailed for that. The other one's just the plain extortions without the blackmail, without having that other one, is just threatening. If you don't do X, Y, Z, we're going to shoot up your house. And particularly in a case in like currently in the Vancouver area we're seeing here, which is gaining a lot of international media attention, they have in other cases been shooting up homes, you know, and basically lighting them up with machine gun fire and automatic weapon fire on our homes. So the whole community, you know, is, you don't have to threaten that much. You just have to say, hey, do you want your house shot up? Or do you want to pay $1 million? You got 24 hours.
Oh, my gosh.
So it happens in a lot of different methods and forms, and I think it's only limited by the imagination and ingenuity of the criminal element.
Yeah, you can't downplay that. Kind of switching topics a little bit. I've got so many questions here, but yeah. I'm just curious, have you ever been involved in a hostage negotiation where the conduct of the hostage, him or herself, really helped the case, helped her, him get their freedom by doing something that helped the, you know, just help the case get solved and in a good direction?
Well, I think in many of the cases that we've worked, particularly the ones, you know, like in the terrorist situations where they're, you know, political, ideologically challenged, or motivated, sorry, the conduct of the hostage themselves in terms of being respectful, empathetic, non-panicking, etc., you know, like where we've seen journalists and others, it has. I mean, we've even seen it, you know, in criminal cases. You know, some criminals, you know, probably they're in that case because they've done something inappropriate to begin with, i.e. ripped off one drug dealer for another drug dealer and then got kidnapped, and some of their family members got kidnapped. And it's hard to say they've done, you know, good things or positive things. But I do think that the conduct of the hostage has a significant role in terms of the success of the kidnapping resolution.
Interesting. And this case has just generated just a tidal wave of interest, and people are dying for information, and people are speculating, and you turn on social media and there's all kinds of stuff that's false that you know is false. Tell me when publicity is good for these cases and when is it detrimental?
I think they're good when the investigative team has a strategy that decides jointly with the family and others and the other stakeholders that it's a wise thing to do. It is usually not good if it's not part of the strategic initiative of the investigative team. And the reason it's quite often not good, like in this particular case, say theoretically it generates a lot of false leads, it sometimes in other cases enhances and amplifies the value of the hostage in terms of, you know, ransom demands. We've seen that a lot in terrorist cases. But I think the defining aspect is who's ever in charge of the investigation will define whether it is or whether it isn't, based on what's the investigative strategy. And I say the investigative strategy, but, you know, I'll shift it and introduce a new word, the resolution strategy. So if it's part of the resolution strategy and it's, you know, there's an overall plan to include it, then it will be helpful. But those, if it's something that's incongruent with the investigative resolution strategy, it will be harmful. And who knows? The people running it.
One final question, and again, this is not in your area of hostage negotiation, but you've been involved in these types of things. You've been involved in criminal investigations. You saw the video, I assume, of the person who was supposedly on our property with the mask on and the gloves, which apparently are now, they were found and probably match what was in the video. Do you have any gut feelings about that video? Any just feelings as a person involved in these investigations that says, cries out for amateur, not amateur, or staged sort of video? What do you think?
Well, I hate, and we've done a super good job, I think.
I know.
You and myself, yeah. In terms of not speculating.
Right.
So I really want to stay on that line. But, I mean, I will say the video, the first thing that crossed my mind when I saw it was somebody that was trying to secure his own DNA.
What do you mean?
They were covered up so sufficiently that look like there was going to be leakage of DNA, whether it be hair or anything that was going to leak out of them. Like they looked like they were, you know, basically all taped up to ensure there wasn't going to be DNA left at the scene.
So in that event, it would have been pre-planned as opposed to some robbery gone wrong, because you don't come to a robbery scene all taped up, I guess.
Yeah, I don't.
It's hard to. Yeah.
I used to work on a burglary section and a robbery section, and rarely did they look like that.
Interesting. Thank you so much for joining us. This is really, really helpful to all of us. Calvin Krusty, he is a senior partner and critical risk consultant in Critical Risk Team. If anyone wants to reach him, you can give me a call at, or actually email me at WGN@AskKarenConti.com, and I will put you in touch with him. Thank you so much, Calvin, and we'll watch this story as it unravels.